that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, it's time to tackle what's become a yearly ritual, our fall television pool. We'll try to guess which shows might live to see another season, or at least finish out this one. Then we'll keep our eyes firmly on the future by talking about the fall films we're excited to see. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table here in our alternate historic Studio 45 for 1 week only. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and theater and that sort of thing, and occasionally I get lost between Studio 44 and Studio 45.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, it's good to all be together again. Last week I was in Toronto, as you all know, and I'm happy to see everyone. We thought that we would get started with our fall TV pool. As regular listeners know, we do this every year, specifically so that I can demonstrate that I don't know anything about audiences or television or what's going to be successful. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that this year will be absolutely no different, but I will go last just to preserve the suspense of my horrible, horrible choices. Mm-hmm. So, Stephen, why don't you go first?
Do I get first?
You can get firsties. And the idea is here, we don't have a specific scoring system. It's usually been pretty easy to tell who does well and who does
badly.
It's
always the one whose show didn't get canceled before the end of the season.
Exactly. Yeah. I always do the worst.
Before the end of the first episode.
Yeah, I always do the worst. Who does the best varies a little bit.
It's usually Tanya.
It was Tanya 1 year when Tanya picked a couple different things.
Well, the thing is, we had Tanya Ballard Brown on as a guest.
Mm-hmm. The first time we did this.
And she picked like six things.
She did.
But the thing is, they all did better than other people.
She picked Once Upon a Time, which lived. She picked Grimm, which lived. She picked Scandal, which lived at that time.
And thrived.
And thrived. She definitely was.
And the
was
first
the
year we did it, I actually was the champion because I picked Revenge.
That's right. And Stephen picked Revenge one time. And somebody picked Nashville. Was it Trey?
I picked Nashville. Yeah.
Trey picked Nashville one time. That's still alive.
Mm. We've been doing this for a while.
Yeah, all of mine die after like three episodes, so my picks are not worth discussing. But we'll talk about what strategy I decided to adopt a little bit later. But as I said, we don't have a specific scoring system. It's usually pretty easy to tell who falls on their face because it's me.
Now, this season to me had a number of very, very strong directions you could go. This seemed to me like an unusually strong batch. And I'm not trying to take everything. I really agonized between two shows. And I sort of felt like, is it okay to pick a cable show?
Uh-huh.
Like, is it okay to...
Well, yeah.
It better be.
I think these days it is.
Between broadcast and cable, it might, if several of us pick successful shows, that might make it tricky. But I'm going to go ahead and just put all my chips on a cable show. I'm going with Showtime's Masters of Sex.
Yes.
Now, is that what you were going to pick?
No.
Okay, good.
Is that an ongoing series?
They hope so. It's one of those things that they announce it as a limited series, which means that they make a season, they consider the season to be a success before it even starts, because they're going to run the whole thing, because that's how cable does it. And
which
then
is
they...
part of why this feels a little bit like cheating, because they're not going to cancel Masters of Sex after three episodes.
You'll be able to tell how you did that.
But I also picked a cable thing, and I think the metric is if it's picked up for something else.
Yes. And they certainly hope, essentially this story goes on so long for so many decades that you could easily have a series that went on for a long time.
Now, it's based on the true story of sex researchers Masters and Johnson.
Correct.
And it's basically, it's sexy Mad Men. How can it fail?
It stars Lizzie Kaplan and Michael Sheen. And
as sexy sex researchers Masters and Johnson who have sex. And you like the show.
I do like it, yes.
You were saying, based on how many episodes have you seen?
Either two or four. I lose track.
Okay, so you've seen either two or four episodes of Masters.
I've seen some of it, more than the pilot.
And I try when I pick these things to... I'm trying not to fall into the Linda Holmes trap of, like, the audience is stupid, therefore my pick is dad.
That is not what I have ever done.
Wow.
That is a filthy lie. Yeah. I have never done that.
You have handicapped. You have gauged. You have thoughtfully prognosticated based on audience viewer habits. Yes? Is that a more fair way to say it?
Yes.
And that's why you picked
I picked in the past. I'd picked Partners, right. which I because it was. You know what? Well, I'm not even doing it. I'm not your whipping post.
Anyway, so I'm picking Masters of Sex because it is sexy Mad Men, and with a bunch of big prestige-y shows wrapping up their run, Breaking Bad about to come to an end, with Mad Men.
It has a limited time left.
There is a vacuum for, particularly, I think, for sexy shows about sexy sex havers to come in.
The sex on this show, you have to remember.
It's clinical.
Right. The sex on this show is more medical and scientific. Hey. And actually, that's part. That's part of what makes it funny. I mean, there is a clip that's gone around. It's a clip in which Beau Bridges is playing the supervisor of Michael Sheen. Are you enjoying the motion I'm making with my hand?
If only you could see the C-shaped.
It is actually just as bad as it looks like it is. Essentially, what happened was that Masters and Johnson had invented what you would think of as a sex toy with a light in it that you could use both to stimulate women and to look inside at the same time. I'll put it that way.
That's pretty medical.
Wow.
And there is a shot of Beau Bridges being warned not to hit himself in the eye with it when he's looking. And so much of the sort of lightness of the show, and there are heavy moments in the show too,
right.
but much of the lightness of the show comes from kind of the awkwardness of studying sex. So I'm not sure it's quite as sexy as you're thinking. Sex research is not necessarily as sexy as non-research sex.
I'm just guessing.
But this is definitely the most times we've ever said sex.
Right.
We're going for, I hope nobody is playing a drinking game.
All right. Well,
anyway,
at any rate,
Masters of Sex on Showtime this fall seems to me, I have a network pick as well, but I'm going to refrain from any runners-up what I was thinking about until other people.
It's certainly a solid pick quality-wise. Trey Graham, what is your pick?
I do have one pick. I did have several runners-up, but I will follow Stephen's lead. Hostages, with Toni Collette as a surgeon who's meant to operate on the President of the United States, and Dylan McDermott as the big bad.
Dermal McDillett.
Conceived by Jerry Bruckheimer. It's set in Washington, D.C. It's a political thriller. It's a family drama. It's all of this complicated business, right?
The problem with Hostages is that it's hard for me to understand how it keeps going.
That was because
this is all given away in the trailers.
Yeah.
So the setup is the surgeon who's set to operate on the president, bad guys come into her house, they take her family hostage, and they say,
"You're going to kill the president of the United States, Ellen. Otherwise, we will kill your family."
Right. It's actually kind of similar to the setup of the mob doctor, but that's a different thing. So my problem is you can't keep them hostages in the house forever. And eventually you have to kind of – that has to evolve in some way. There's only so long you can keep her family.
It seemed much more like the plot of a movie.
Yeah.
Right?
That's kind of what I thought. And when they gave the – panel at Press Tour, they sort of said, well, you know, eventually it's possible that they won't be literal hostages.
Oh, yes.
They'll be symbolic hostages. And I was like, of course they will.
Emotional hostages.
So the question becomes, like, where can you go with this idea? I think it's a solid pick in terms of audience potential.
Right.
There are definitely some higher profile actors in it. And
The production values look really solid.
Yeah. And there is a thing, after people have had a chance to see it, we will talk about something that we talked about at Press Tour as a plot choice that looks like they're going to make this plot choice in the pilot, and then they take it back. And we asked, did you take it back because you thought you had to take it back? And they said yes, and we'll explain that after you've had a chance to see Hostages. Glenn Weldon.
All right, I am going to name some of the ones I didn't pick, because so certain am I that you, Linda Holmes, did not pick any of these. Now, y'all think I'm going to pick Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Well, duh.
Because, you know, I am who I am and whatever. But I got layers. And also, I talked to people who saw it at Comic-Con. And
I saw it at Press Tour.
Can I ask?
Go ahead.
Do your layers include Atlantis?
All right. And these are smart people. These are insightful people, and they were over the moon about it. But they saw it at Comic-Con,
right.
Which is like going to a strawberry festival and asking people, what do you think of strawberries? Pretty good?
Yeah.
So So this series, like a lot of the kind of high concept series this fall, Almost Human, which is about a dystopia where there's a cop and an android, his android partner, which
Mac
is just
cheese.
A ripoff of Holmes and Yo-Yo, John Chuck's magnum opus, the show Dracula, the show Sleepy Hollow. Uh-huh. They're taking something that Joss Whedon's Buffy perfected, which is this idea of combining a season-long arc with individual stories. And I am just tired of that dynamic. I started to get into Once Upon a Time.
You don't want to have to keep track of the season-long dynamic, do you?
Well, it's just that thing I'm just not interested
that
in.
That balance is hard to draw well.
Well, it is, and it's also, once you know that that's the formula, you can kind of feel it coming, and you just rub up against it, as it were. So, Nick, hit me with my actual pick.
Hello, ladies.
Hello, ladies. Hello, ladies. Where the party at?
Up your ass.
There's no need for that in front of ladies.
Oh, you want to stop me?
No.
Okay. As you might have gathered, that is Hello, Ladies, starring Stephen Merchant. Now, Stephen Merchant is, of course, a collaborator with Ricky Gervais. And if you've ever listened to the Ricky Gervais podcast, they're both on there. They're trading back and forth. As odious as many things Gervais have become over time, Stephen Merchant maintains this air of sweetness. He comes off, certainly in that podcast, as a guy who's less prone to self-aggrandizement and nastiness. So this is a story of a very tall, hapless Brit who navigates the L.A. dating scene. And so it's going to be, cringe comedy. It's only 8 episodes. It starts September 29th
it's HBO.
At 10:30 on HBO, right after the finale of Breaking Bad. So it'll be a good...
It's going to have a little bit of a
little bit of a lead-in.
Of course, everybody will be sitting there just rocking back.
Yes, exactly. Breaking Bad will have just and we need to cringe. Yeah. That's what we need at that point. I am looking forward to it. I think this guy's very funny. It's based on his comedy special of the same name. And I think by exploring the L.A. club scene, if you will, the L.A. dating scene from this guy's perspective, it will come off as the anti-Entourage.
Oh, yeah.
I'm all for that.
Yeah.
Anything that is not Entourage. So again, the metric will be if it gets picked up for a second series. Because it's HBO. Sure. They don't really cancel things. I mean, they stop running Luck, right? But that's not really canceled.
That was different.
That was much different.
That was a little different. That was circumstances.
Yeah.
So, okay. As I approached this task, I kept in mind that I've often been accused of being too cynical when I make these decisions. It is not because I think the audience is stupid. I just try to remove my own tastes from it.
So you pick dads.
Stop.
Mom.
I try to remove my own tastes from the equation and go with what it seems to me people are going to potentially embrace based on what they've embraced before.
Okay.
Trying to be brutally pragmatic, but that has failed. Completely, miserably. I'm the worst every year. So this year I decided I'm going to go with my heart. I'm going to pick my actual favorite. Now, for my actual favorite, my runner-up, since we're doing that, was The Michael J. Fox Show.
Right. I was wondering if anybody was going to pick
which that. Which I really like, and which I think has a decent chance of success for a variety of reasons. It's really funny. It's enjoyable. It's him doing genuinely a different kind of comedy. And I think people may really respond well to it. So that wouldn't surprise me a bit. But my actual pick is a Fox comedy called Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
That was going to be my network pick if I'd gone with the network.
That was also
and
mine.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine is a cop show starring, surprisingly enough to me, Andy Samberg, who I have not always loved. But it's Andy Samberg and Andre Brower. And Nick's going to play you a little clip.
I'm pumped to be on a stakeout with my two best friends.
Does he always talk as much?
I just tune it out. It's like a white noise machine.
That's racist.
Okay. So Brooklyn Nine-Nine, what I like about it is it's kind of, if I were to compare it to a show, it's more like Barney Miller or something like that. It's crime, but it's comedy. Mm-hmm. It's comedy at the police station.
And there's a vacuum for that.
They haven't been doing that as much recently. There have been a lot of really dark crime shows, but not as much kind of like cop show comedy, which there were a lot of questions asked, like, can you get away with that? Are people going to be willing to laugh at murder police and stuff like that? But the pilot's really funny. And Andre Brower, if you've ever seen Andre Brower do funny, he's very, very funny. But he's very funny in this incredibly incredibly just wafer dry way that for me is a great balance to Andy Samberg, who is funny in this
much more the top, he's the wisecracker,
kind of over the top kind of way. So Andy Samberg is somebody that I struggled with for a long time comedy wise, but then I saw him in Celeste and Jesse Forever, which is Rashida Jones' movie, and all these people are connected, among other things, by the fact that Rashida Jones was on Parks and Rec. Andy Samberg did a guest shot on Parks and Rec, and Parks and Rec is done by Michael Schur, who is one of the creators of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And Schur is one of my favorite current people in comedy, as people know. I love Parks and Rec. I love he used to do a blog called Fire Joe Morgan, which was wonderful. So I was a little bit predisposed to like it, but I really do like it, and I think it's very successful, and I think that it brings a lot to the table in terms of it's legitimately really funny, and it contains funny jokes. And there are times when you just want your comedy to not
to
be
contain
so,
funny jokes.
To not be so dark and so arch and so kind of pointed, but you just want it to contain great jokes. And there's one that's in one of the trailers where you start to hear this like kind of cop show music in the background, this like synthy cop show music, and then it turns out that Andy Samberg is noodling on an electric keyboard. And it's just funny. It's little throwaway gags like that, and there are so many of them that I enjoyed it a lot.
Well, this was going to be my pick if we had decided we couldn't use cable.
Right.
And so I was reading up on it a little bit, and I was just reading an article about it where they're describing a scene, and just in the description of the scene, I laughed.
It's
like a reenactment, and there's somebody who's just not doing it right. So eventually they just have him playing a door. It made me laugh.
I think you will get a kick out of it. But come find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what fall shows you are looking forward to and which one of us you think is going to be left with egg on their face. Spoiler alert, it will be me because it's always me. No matter what strategy I use, I am always the loser and I'm sure I will be again. And I apologize to Mike Schur in advance for picking his show.
and therefore
dooming it to failure. So as I mentioned earlier, I am relatively recently back from the Toronto Film Festival, and that has gotten us in the mind of talking about fall films and the good ones. And, you know, as Stephen has commented a couple times to me, it does feel like there's this dry spell in the summer. And in some ways, all the way dating back to the dump of the spring and there kind of being nothing to see. And then all of a sudden in the fall, you kind of feel like there's all these things where you're like, oh, I'm kind of excited to see that. And we're kind of getting into that season.
Yeah, you basically have this point where by the end of the summer, everybody files their essays about how cinema is dead.
Right.
And then there's a film festival and everybody's like, I can't wait to see all the great movies.
Yes, it's true. So we thought that we would take this opportunity, since we've been enjoying the sort of round-robin-y nature of this episode, we thought we would go around and talk about a movie that we are excited to see between now and perhaps the end of the year, the end of the fall. What have you. Let's go the other way. Glenn Weldon.
Nick, play me a clip.
I like it already.
In a world.
Yeah.
You seek that which would bestow upon you the right to rule. The quest to reclaim a homeland.
Is that a Hiddleston speaking?
It's not.
Oh.
That is not. This is The Hobbit. The Desolation of Smaug. Now hear me out.
I just wanted to say Smaug.
I know y'all are tired of dishwashing dwarves who sing songs about dishwashing.
Sure
I know the first 45 minutes of the first film, The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, wasn't about an unexpected journey. It was about an unexpected thinking about going on a journey. I understand it. I've heard all this. It's become memes. But you have to understand, this book, The Hobbit, should not have been divided into three films, but it's what we're stuck with. And I guarantee...
This is the best sales pitch I've ever heard.
What we're stuck with, Glenn Weldon, NPR.
That this second film, The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, is from the best part of the book.
Is this what you're saying, where stuff gets real?
I would never say that.
Where something actually happens.
I would never use that expression. But the first book was all set up because you have to understand that Bilbo is a different kind of hobbit than Frodo. Bilbo is even more complacent, more unadventurous. So we need to kind of push him out the door.
That's great.
All right. And the final... part of the book is about the Battle of the Five Armies, which I found completely uninvolving. And Tolkien did too. He had, as I mentioned, he had his main character fall asleep, actually get knocked out, and miss the entire battle. This part of the book has Beorn, a big, burly bear of a man who helps them out. So, yes. It has giant spiders. It has this moment, kind of like the Riddles in the Dark from the first film. It has this back and forth between Martin Freeman's Bilbo and Benedict Cumberbatch's Smaug the dragon. So it's like you have that thing going on. But
Cumberbatch really is playing everybody this really, year.
Yeah, he's kind of cashing in while he can.
But here's the thing. It also has Thranduil, king of the Wood Elves of Mirkwood. And he's played by Lee Pace. Lee Pace, listeners will remember from many things, including Pushing Daisies, or as it was known in my house, Twee's Company. Burn. But Lee Thranduil had a cameo in the first Hobbit film. We see him up on top of a ridge. Mm-hmm. He's an elf riding a moose, right. Because sure, elves ride moose.
And he just sort of sits on the ridge and looks condescending for a little bit.
He looks down to decide whether or not he's going to have the elves help the dwarves in their battle against the dragon. And then he turns away. And the way he turns away is so fey. Imagine Roddy McDowell getting invited to the Playboy Mansion. He peeks inside the grotto and he says, "Oh, I think decidedly not." And he turns away.
The grotto is so gross, man.
It's like, did you say there were canapes over here? Like, that's the kind of...
Roddy McDowell would never even look in the grotto.
It's true. It's true. But this, I am really looking forward to, because everything we've seen about how Lee Pace is playing Thranduil is just going to be, it's going to be so much fun.
Every time you talk about a guy up on a ridge, I think about how high a ridge.
I could not tell
from, Waiting for Guffin. Oh, sorry.
So anyway, yes, I am What's Wrong with America. I am waiting for a blockbuster sequel.
A blockbuster sequel to a film that you admit was
kind of
deeply
dull.
Flawed.
It's the structure. It's the structure. Don't mess with the structure.
Deeply flawed. All right. That's okay. That's okay. Trey Graham, how about you? Are you looking for the third Hobbit movie?
I am not, in fact. I am looking for a couple of small things in the coming months. I have a soft spot in my heart for a film that may not do very well because it might just wrong-foot people. They may not know quite how to approach it. That's in part because it stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who is not particularly well known for her movie roles and, you know, sort of being a success on the big screen. But it's also in part because it stars James Gandolfini in the final thing. I think it's the final thing that we will have from him.
It's not being billed as his final work. Okay. I believe he's in other.
But it's a film called Enough Said, and it is about this man and this woman, played by those two actors, who meet, and then it turns out that her massage therapist / new best friend is his ex-wife. And so she has all this excess sort of knowledge about where the relationship might go. And so it's kind of about her negotiating that. I want this to succeed.
Did you see it?
No, I haven't seen it.
Okay.
But I'm deeply curious about it, and I want it to succeed.
Yeah. I saw that one in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to like it, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I like certain things about it. Gandolfini's amazing in it. Really wonderful and warm and funny. And it's going to be revelatory for people who haven't seen this side of him. The question comes up because, like you said, she makes a new best friend who is the ex-wife of her new boyfriend.
Catherine Keener, right?
Right, played by Catherine Keener. And this is Nicole Holofcener.
Holofcener.
And when she continues to know both of them without telling either of them.
Right.
It winds up feeling like a very bad thing to do to both of them.
Sure.
And my struggle was to not simply grow to just think she was a monstrously selfish person. But I'll be curious to see what you think, because the performances are really interesting. I liked a bunch of the people. And I sat there the entire time looking at the daughter in this movie. Not Tavi Gevinson. Tavi Gevinson, who's a fashion blogger, plays the daughter's friend. And it was hard enough for me to figure out where I knew her from. And then I was like, Judge from Project Runway All-Stars.
There you go.
Which is how I knew her. But the daughter, I was sitting there going, who is that? I know that girl. Who is that? She was the daughter in Deadly Spa.
That is absolutely true. Hooray.
She was the daughter in Deadly Spa.
Well, as you mentioned, this is from Nicole Holofcener, and that's one of the things that intrigues me about it. I like her sensibility, mm-hmm. her storytelling sensibility. Mm-hmm. I also like that she is willing to give you a main character that you've kind of got to grapple with mm-hmm. in that way.
Yeah. I'll be interested to see, like I said, what you think.
But that is not actually the movie I picked. I picked a movie involving a journalist. He's not at his best when we meet him, and he's at a cocktail party, and he overhears someone say this.
I know this woman. She had a baby when she was a teenager, and she's kept it secret for 50 years.
And what you're talking about would be what they call a human interest story, and that's, I don't do those.
Why not?
You think I should do a human interest story?
And that's Steve Coogan is the journalist. And the woman who had a baby and gave him up 50 years ago is played by Judi Dench. Her name is Philomena, which is also the title of the movie. It is directed by Stephen Frears, who has brought us a number of wonderful movies over the decades, not least Dangerous Liaisons. And I am very, very curious to see how this plays out, because in addition to these sort of deeply felt moments, it is clearly going to have some comic beats to it, because toward the end of the trailer, you have Steve Coogan and Judi Dench walking through, I think, a field or a car park or something. And the setup must be something about not knowing more about her options when it comes to dealing with a child that she can't keep. And she turns to him and says,
I didn't even know I had a clitoris, Martin.
Right.
Oh, nice. Excellent. Perfect.
This is the sexiest episode of Pop
really
Culture
is.
Happy Hour ever.
Yes, I think that was actually a runner-up for the Audience Award at TIFF, I think.
Yeah.
Stephen Thompson.
You know, it's funny, Trey, when you said about a journalist, I assumed you were talking about The Fifth Estate.
I thought you might.
Because it's Benedict Cumberbatch, right, and Trey rarely misses an opportunity.
I thought it was Anchorman 2.
Or Anchorman 2, which I will confess I'm kind of excited about.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, so Benedict Cumberbatch this fall will be playing Julian Assange and a dragon.
And some other things.
And some other things.
That ain't all.
Yeah.
He's also in August Osage County with Meryl Streep and Julie Roberts.
Which you've seen.
Meryl Streep, Julia Roberts, and all of the Oscars.
And everyone else. And he's also in 12 Years a Slave.
Oops,
where he
all
plays
the other
a
Oscars.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the movies that I wanted to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Funnily enough, because I hear it's a lighthearted romp.
Yeah.
There are singing, dancing skeletons with British accents, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. So 12 Years a Slave.
I will say Benedict Cumberbatch dances in The Fifth Estate and sings in August Osage County.
And is a dragon.
Can we just rename this podcast The Cumberbatch Show?
We needn't. 12 Years a Slave was the big thing, it seemed to me news-wise, to come out of the Toronto International Film Festival. It's directed by Steve McQueen. It stars Chiwetel Ejiofor he's kidnapped.
Right.
He's a free
black man in New York in the 1840s, and he's kidnapped and sold into slavery because they strip him of his identity and things like that, and then they just take him down to the South and sell him, and you could do that. That was something that could happen to people, and it's a very terrifying idea.
And it basically, there was this amazing, it spoke to how short the news cycles are nowadays, that at like 10 a.m. on a Saturday, word broke that the Oscars race is over.
Yep.
This will win Best Picture.
Yeah.
It will win Best Actor. It will win Best Everything.
Yeah.
This is the movie of the year. This is a movie people will be talking about in 50 years.
Yeah.
Later that day, and probably by about 2 or 3, you had chimed in, Linda, on Twitter and said, seriously, the hype you're hearing on this movie, this is an amazing movie. Like, this really is not overstating. And kind of by the end of the day, I heard something else about it. And I was like, God, jeez, this movie. When is this movie coming out? Like, why am I still hearing about this?
When did the hype machine end?
God, the hype just has gone on and on for hours and hours.
It's true.
Finally, our long national nightmare of waiting for this movie will end on October 18th when it at least starts rolling out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's amazing how incredibly impatient we are as people.
That's true.
Certainly how impatient I am, because I seriously was like, by the end of
you're not lying.
So I wanted to talk about that one, because that's clearly one of the major films that we'll be talking about this year. The other one is we've talked a little bit about sequels and what's coming out sequel wise. You've got your Anchorman 2, you've got your The Hobbit: The Desolation of Smaug, you've got Catching Fire, The second Hunger Games movie. You've got Thor: The Dark World.
Yes.
The sequel I am excited about. Can you guess, Linda?
Yes, I can.
Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2.
I am seeing it this Saturday morning at 10 a.m. I am getting out of my house to get up and get to a 10 o'clock screening.
I'll believe it when I hear it.
I know in the past, at some point on this podcast, we mentioned that Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 1 is fantastic.
It's the most delightful movie.
It's completely delightful.
Totally delightful.
One of my favorite animated movies.
Speaking of packed with good jokes.
Mm-hmm. Just stuffed with jokes and charming and funny and
just the,
sweet.
When your entire premise is a gigantic Rube Goldberg contraption that turns weather into food. It's just amazing.
I'm curious because box office-wise, one of the big movie stories of the year was Despicable Me 2.
Mm-hmm.
And the first Despicable Me movie came out and clearly accumulated so much goodwill. That by the time the second Despicable Me movie came out, and it was not they didn't pour $300 million into Despicable Me 2, but they certainly poured more than that much out the other end.
Right.
And what I'm wondering is if Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which comes out September 27th, if it has accumulated as much goodwill. Because to me, I've seen both Despicable Me and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, and I like them both, but really prefer Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Yeah, I think this has a good chance of being another big honkin' surprise moneymaker.
Yeah.
Maybe not that much of a surprise, but, you know, a big moneymaker that is not on anybody's prestige list.
I can only say subjectively that, like, nobody in the comedy nerd community was really talking that much about Despicable Me, but everybody is talking about Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs because, again, as you mentioned,
it's
jokes.
Funny.
Jokes
count. Funny. There are jokes everywhere.
Excellent. Good choices. Good choices. And good variety. I like it.
How about you?
Here, hit me with my clip, Nick.
Tim, my dear son, this is going to sound strange, but there's this family secret that the men in the family can travel in time.
This is such a weird joke.
It's not a joke.
If it's true, which it isn't.
Although it is.
But if it was, which it's not.
Which it is.
How would I actually...
You go into a dark place, clench your fists, think of the moment you're going to, and you'll find yourself there.
Okay. So this is a trailer that has utterly charmed me for a movie that I have not seen yet.
And it's been utterly charming you for like 8 months, right? Because I've seen this trailer for a long time.
It's called About Time, and it stars Bill Nye, the British actor, not the science guy, as the father of this young man who learns from his father that the men in the family, as explained in the clip, can travel in time. And the basic way that this functions is they can go back in time and essentially relive moments and things like that. And I, based on the trailer alone, I like what they're doing with this idea. I like the fact that they're talking about how if you change one thing, you change a lot of other things. And it's basic time travel stuff, but there are a couple of moments in that trailer that I think are really swoony and lovely. And I have a kind of very warm, happy response to it, even though I sense that it's going to be a little bit of a weepy movie. I just was instantly drawn to it. It was one of those where I just instantly thought, I will go see that on the first weekend, and I will put my little feet up and have my little drink, and I will love seeing that movie just kind of for this charming idea.
I saw that trailer on a date night, and I had exactly the same reaction.
Yeah.
Because he's using the time travel thing to try and correct a relationship failing. Is that a good way to say it?
Right. And this is written and directed by Richard Curtis, who did Love Actually, which people have mixed feelings about, but also Notting Hill, which is one of my favorites in terms
maybe
of
the least divisive romantic comedy.
In terms of contemporary romantic comedy, is very, very good. And incidentally, I've mentioned this now, I think twice on the radio at NPR, but I'm also going to mention contemporary romantic comedies. It's going to be a while before it comes out because it just got picked up. But I saw a romantic comedy called The F Word with Daniel Radcliffe and Zoe Kazan. And remember the day I told you, you're going to love it. It's really, really wonderful.
Going back to About Time. Mm-hmm. What's the name of the actor playing the kid, the younger guy?
I actually don't know.
Okay. Because I thought the first time I saw that clip, he was going to say, yeah, and your father is Hugh Grant. That's the secret. Because this guy is channeling.
He's giving you a little early.
He's
Hugh
giving
Grant.
You a little early.
He's giving you a little early. Don't try to ruin it for me, Lynn.
Not gonna ruin it.
So that is the one that I am excited about, and I have not seen it yet. So that is on the list of ones that that I am anxiously awaiting.
Nice.
So that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week, Stephen Thompson? What is making you happy this week?
Well, as of this taping, it is Monday, September 16th, and last night they gave out the Creative Arts Division of the Emmy Awards.
As we have called the Schmemmies in the past.
The Schmemmies, exactly. And the actual Emmys are this coming weekend. We will be talking about those next week. But there were two awards given out that made me just over the moon, incredibly happy. And no, I am not talking about Undercover Boss winning Best Reality Show. These two awards made up for that fact. One is that they gave the Governor's Award to June Foray, the wonderful 95-year-old voice actress, Rocky and Bullwinkle, on through absolutely everything ever. You know, honoring somebody like that while she's still alive and can stand up and hold a trophy is delightful. The other one, I'm sure you guys know where I'm going with this, 7 times nominated for the first time, Bob Newhart won an Emmy. And
I believe that's his first.
It's astonishing.
I think the reason it's his first is part of what is so wonderful about Bob Newhart, which is that he's understated. There aren't all these
He is the unshowiest of comedians.
The unshowiest of comedians. And another person who has been absolutely delighting people for way longer than I've been alive. And part of what I love about seeing him honored in that way is he got up on stage and took his trophy and wept.
Oh.
And you could sense that it just meant the world to him. He won. It was a guest award for his performance on The Big Bang Theory.
It's a really funny episode. They did a great job kind of taking advantage of his playing him against Parsons, which if you kind of know Jim Parsons, it makes sense.
I wrote a fan letter to you when I was a child in Texas, and you sent this autographed picture back to me. Do you remember that?
I'll give you a hint. I have a bracelet with my own address on it.
Well, anyway, you may find this hard to believe, but I didn't have any friends growing up.
No, I get that.
It was a wonderfully funny episode, and he was wonderful on it.
And so seeing him not only honored, but seeing him being honored to be honored just is making me incredibly
happy.
Really
nice.
Great.
It's great.
Fantastic. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
Our buddy Bob Mondello and our own Mrs. Stamberg can attest to the credentials of the great and good John Palmer Claridge, who is a chef who makes crazy good food, like really super fancy food, and as an arts booster and a theater nerd. So today, when John Palmer Claridge sent me a link on YouTube, I clicked on it, and I discovered at the other end of it a delightful YouTube video in which members of various orchestras from around the UK step out from behind their instruments and have a moment in the spotlight. It's a produced segment. It was part of the BBC Proms a few years ago. And it's about seeing them as individuals rather than as part of these seamless artistic collectives. And the song that they choose for them to sing is kind of thematically on point.
I won't be afraid with you. We shall have the world.
That is Take Me to the World from Evening Primrose. It's a song sung by a young woman who has lived her life in a department store to the young man, and then eventually as a duet with a young man who is going to be her ticket out. It's performed by members of the Ulster Orchestra, the BBC Philharmonic, and other orchestras affiliated with the BBC. It is very sweet. And it's funny that when you were talking about Bob Newhart, it made me think about this, because it's not trying to be anything big. They're not fabulous. It's just sweet and kind and a little silly, especially after the 3-minute mark in this video when they start having flubs, and they've left some of the flubs in to show you kind of what these people's personalities are like. I just enjoyed it a great deal, and I hope you will too.
Wonderful. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I went to the Small Press Expo in Bethesda this weekend, SPX as it's known. It's indie comics, it's mini comics, and it's great, and people should go to it. I tend to focus more on the panels than in the mingling part, but...
you don't say.
Yeah. There was this one panel early on with Dash Shaw, who's book, New School, I've talked about on the show before. Yep. And a slightly older guy named Frank Santoro, who's been around forever. And they were talking just about their approaches. And it was a fascinating discussion because Dashaw's a young guy. He has a manifesto. He has very strong opinions because that's what you want out of a young artist, right? You know, he said something along the lines of, you know, artists know that there is no difference between thinking and feeling. There is no difference between intuition and planning. It's all coming from you, so it's all of the same thing. It sounded less pretentious when he said it. Mm-hmm. And Frank Santoro was talking about, you know, he has ties to the fine art community, and he's used to being looked down upon. And it was heartening to see that Dashaw has no idea about that. But the thing that I want to say that you can actually get is, first of all, New School, it's fantastic and it's great. But Frank Santoro's book, Pompeii, he talked about how he doesn't really like this whole idea of inking a book so that everything always looks the same, because he wants the book to, like, when Pompeii is the story of a very simple story taking place right before Mount Vesuvius erupts in 79 AD. A very simple story, deliberately simple, so that he can do things like when it's a sexy, sexy scene, the line work gets very heavy and sexy. And when a character is nervous, the line work is a little scratchy. And when the narrator is just kind of looking passively at something, the line work gets very simple, because that's what he wants to it's about expressing what's going on at the time of the story. It's about mm-hmm. using art and words in a really interesting way. So check it out, Pompeii by Frank Santoro.
Thank you. I will say first that one of the things making me happy this week has been, as Stephen mentioned earlier, Breaking Bad is two episodes away from the end and has gotten very dark. To the surprise of no one, has gotten very dark. And one of the things that has really lightened it for me in the last few weeks...
Have been the musical numbers?
has been that Aaron Paul, who plays Jesse Pinkman on that show, for some reason just loves talking about how excited he is about being on that show and how much he loves it, to the point where our friends at Previously.tv actually had a website at one point that I can't quote the full name of because it has a swear in it. But it was essentially the entire website has Aaron Paul tweeted that the bleep is going to hit the fan on Breaking Bad this week, and it either says yes or no. And they would toggle it once he said that, because he would say it every week. So I'm finding him very entertaining and very, you know, and there's a lot of feeling going into it as they get to the end of this project. And it's just been fun to kind of like watch him just be a weirdo. And if you've never seen the clip of when he was on Price is Right, you have to see the clip of when he was on Price is Right.
You can't mention Aaron Paul without
worth it. You can't.
An elegant flat top desk. Aaron, what do you bid on that?
$1,200.
$1,200. Actual retail price, $1,797. Get him over here. Right here, Aaron. Congratulations.
It's completely awesome. It's so him. You realize how much of him is in parts of Jesse Pinkman. So that's one thing. And the other thing I wanted to mention, Stephen mentioned 12 Years a Slave, which I will talk about more, which I think is a really, really fantastic movie. But the thing specifically that's making me happy is that 12 Years a Slave won the Audience Award mm-hmm. at the Toronto Festival. And, you know, Audience Awards sometimes are more likely to go to movies that feel really good, you know, often really good movies. I'm not saying audiences are dumb. I'm saying awards tend to go to movies that have a little bit more kind of pizzazz to them. I was expecting maybe Gravity, mm-hmm. the space movie mm-hmm. with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney.
Which has also gotten raves.
It's absolutely wonderful to look at. The script is pretty cornball, but but it's wonderful to look at. Or maybe like Rush, the Ron Howard auto racing movie, which a lot of people like. I was so on it. And in fact, one of the other runners-up, in addition to Philomena, which Trey had mentioned, was Prisoners, which is coming out with Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal, which people are a little divided on, but I really liked. It's darker and creepier than the trailer makes it look like, I will say. So don't go thinking it's going to be like a Mel Gibson revenge.
Give me back my time.
That's not what it is. It's weirder than that. But I was really happy to see that audiences, this is not a movie that feels like work, even though it's very, very, very sad and hard to watch at times. It's also just really beautifully made and beautifully acted and beautifully crafted. And I was really happy to see audiences just put their arms around it and really, really be fond of it, even though it's really, really challenging to watch. So that is the other thing making me happy this week, is that audience award. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like Alexander Graham Bell. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Nick Fountain, at Nick Fountain, Nick like Nick, Fountain like Fountain. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.